loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening. It's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. NATO's General Secretary Jens Stoltenberg visited Donald Trump at the White House yesterday. Despite the hype around the U.S. abandoning the alliance, the Trump administration has, in fact, moved rapidly towards the traditional neoconservative approach of hypermilitarism. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson met with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow yesterday as U.S.-Russia tensions soured following the U.S. cruise missile attack on Syria. What came of the meeting between the two, and what does it mean for the new Cold War? The former president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, has registered as a candidate in the upcoming presidential election despite the urging of the country's supreme leader not to do so. What does Ahmadinejad's bid for Iran, the region, and the world mean? But first, we turn to the meeting between NATO's General Secretary Jens Stoltenberg with Donald Trump at the White House yesterday. Despite the hype around the U.S. abandoning the alliance, the Trump administration has, in fact, moved rapidly towards a traditional neoconservative approach of hypermilitarism. We are joined from Berlin by Rainer Braun, co-president of the International Peace Bureau. Welcome, Rainer.
Welcome. Good evening from Europe.
Good evening. Yeah, thank you for joining us. Well, Jens Stoltenberg met with Donald Trump yesterday at the White House. At the press conference after their meeting, Trump said of the alliance, "I said it was obsolete. It's no longer obsolete." Ah, by decree, Donald Trump has relieved NATO from being obsolete. It's brought back into relevance. The other thing he said, Rainer, is that U.S.-Russia relations were at sort of an all-time low. What was your take?
You know, first of all, I have nothing other expected from such a meeting. Both sides agreed that NATO must be strong and that all the countries have to pay more for military budget. Let me say it very clear. The United States, as a key player in the NATO, wants that all the other NATO partners are playing more, but want to go together with them to different wars in the world. They enlarge all their relations to Asia, to surround China, and they build the missile defense shield against Russia. They modernize their nuclear weapons all around the world. NATO has continued what it was since his existence, an aggressive military alliance. It never changed the character, and both sides on the Atlantic agree now again that this will be the future of NATO when the peace movements in the world or all over the world is not fighting against NATO.
In March, Donald Trump complained that Germany, that's you, Rainer, I'm giving you responsibility for all of Germany, that Germany owes vast sums of money to NATO and the United States, and it must be paid more for the powerful and very expensive defense we, the United States, provide to Germany. As a German, how do you react to that?
You know, I'm not a member of the German government. Our chancellor and, above all, our minister of defense would say, "Great that you asked this for us. We want to do this. This was our wish since many years." And, you know, they signed the agreement from Warsaw and Wales before Trump came to power that they want to pay the 2%. They are now have a new argument to do it. But this is stupid, horrible, and against the interests of the people.
It didn't really come from Trump either. I mean, this is from 2014. I mean, it was quite recent that the U.S. government under President Barack Obama was the one telling the NATO countries, you have to pay more of your national budget for military. You have to up it to 2%.
Yes. You know, so that is not new. The only thing Trump is doing is to force us to do it this quicker. And that is the problem of our government. Our people, the people in Europe, don't want to spend more money for military purposes. We need the money for social activities, for environmental purposes, for education, for health care, and not for tanks and not for bombs. So how to convince people that don't want to spend more money? So you have to tell them step by step that they have to. And you have to create the enemy picture, Russia. This is the background of the whole campaign they are doing. They are misusing many things to accuse Russia, which spent less money for military purposes than Trump would additionally spend 2018 for military purposes. The military budget of Russia in 2016 is $53 billion. The additional amount of money Trump wants to spend for 2018 is $54 billion. Who is aggressive against whom? Alone to look at the figures, you can see that is the United States, that is NATO, which is in totally paying $800 billion for military purposes, which is an aggressive alliance fighting against Russia, coming with the NATO nearer and nearer to the border against the spirit of the Paris Charter from 1990 and all the agreements at the end of the Cold War era. So for me, this meeting of these both guys was underlining the traditional old character of NATO and shows the new role of NATO, which I named Global NATO. NATO is not any longer only North Atlantic. NATO is opening her relations to Japan, to South Korea, to Malaysia, and to Indonesia. So we have not only a North Atlantic military alliance, we have a global military alliance with two main players, one main player, the United States, and the next new player is the United Militarized Europe. And this is the danger for the whole world.
Jen Stoltenberg remarked that the most important part about dealing with Russia, quote, is deploying more troops in the eastern part of NATO, increasing defense spending, and keeping a stable alliance. Now, you're in Europe. Many of our listeners are here in the United States. So sadly, there's a profound, ignorance, I would say, about how Europeans think and feel about these kind of issues. We get all of our news filtered through the mainstream media, which is like a drumbeat, like an echo chamber. How do the German people feel, based on your understanding there, or the people of Eastern and Central Europe, about the idea of deploying more troops on Russia's border? Does it make people feel safer? Are the German people scared of Russia right now?
Principally, in general, more weapons and more weapons nearer to the borders makes never a situation more safe. It makes us unsafer than we are now. And the German people and the big majority of the Europeans wanted and need peaceful relations to Russia. Russia is a part of Europe. Peace in Europe is impossible without peaceful relations to the biggest country of the world, to Russia. That is what we want. We have the experience with that. We had quite good relations in the 70s and 80s, and we could develop a lot of personal, economic, social, environmental, scientific contacts with Russia. This was really good for both sides, and this we have to continue. On the top of rockets and tanks, you will never get peaceful relations. So we have to come back to a politics which was created by the famous social democratic politicians in Europe, Willy Brandt, Olaf Palme, Bruno Kreisky, a politics of common security, which means your side has legitimate interests and the other side has legitimate interests. And you have to find the common point of interest and to negotiate this, to feel dialogue, and to work together in a peaceful manner, but not with more military aggressions and more military activities. This will not help to solve any problem in Europe. We will never solve the problem of Ukraine and definitely not of Syria when we continue to militarize the international relations between the big countries.
We're speaking with Rainer Braun. He's the co-president of the International Peace Bureau. We're talking to him from Berlin about the meeting between NATO General Secretary Jens Stoltenberg with Donald Trump yesterday and the following press conference that they held. Rainer, I want to ask you what your opinion is about why NATO even continues to exist as an entity. So it was formed in 1948-49, more or less as a political alliance. It became a real military alliance because of the Korean War, because of then the global contest between the Soviet socialist bloc countries and the United States. In 1955, the Warsaw Pact, which was the military alliance led by the Soviet Union along with its Eastern and Central European socialist government allies, it formed a kind of symmetry. There was a parallel structure with NATO. So it was NATO versus the Warsaw Pact, East versus West, both sides having nuclear weapons. But then at the end of the 1980s, most of the Soviet allied governments in Eastern and Central Europe changed. Most of them became sort of oriented towards the West. The Soviet Union itself collapsed or imploded in 1991. The Warsaw Pact was no more. At that time, people thought, hey, there's going to be a peace dividend. Instead of spending literally trillions of dollars for endless war, these alliances can go away and we can spend the money on things human beings actually need, like housing, like healthcare, like jobs, like education, like food, like to get rid of poverty. Why is NATO still in existence?
Yeah, from my understanding, there are three main points which official politicians mean that they need NATO. First is they need NATO for the interventional wars they are doing all over the world. They need NATO in Afghanistan. They need NATO in Iraq. They need NATO partly and more in Syria. And they need NATO for the globalized economic interests of the Western capitalistic countries. This is the main reason for NATO. NATO should secure the trade ways, the resources, which the Western capitalistic system needs for its development. That is one main reason. The second main reason is they believe that they can win the fight against the so-called terrorists with military purposes. This is the deepest illusion they have. We had in the beginning of these fights in 1999 or 2001, we had about 500 to 1,000 terrorists. Today we have a minimum of 150,000. Then we continue doing this like we are doing it, we will have 1.5 million. But they believe that they can win these fights against these terrorists with military purposes. When Trump is speaking, we will kill all ISIS people. That is the horrible top of these military beliefs that they can win the fight against the terrorists with military purposes. You can only win this with more equality, more development of the world, overcome the poorness and the poverty of many people. And the third point, I think, they really never trust Russia and they want to stop the development of China. So they are trying to circumvent these countries to build troops and bases around all these two big blocks. You have in mind that NATO has 700 bases, Russia has 5 and China 2. So you can see who is trying to reduce the influence of whom.
So, yeah, those are good numbers. Those are extremely good numbers. I want to add one more possible reason NATO still exists, which is that it's just a self-perpetuating bureaucracy and sort of a slush fund for military contractors in Europe and the United States, because, of course, they make lots of money. When they say to the governments of Europe and the United States, of course, you must pay 2% of your gross domestic product for military goods, that means that's money that's not going somewhere else, like to meet human needs, but it is going in the form of secured defense contracts, and these contracts are basically free of competition. In other words, it's kind of a subsidy. It's a subsidy for corporate entities, and particularly the corporate entities that make weapons, and thus that becomes an incentivizer for more violence.
But, you know, there is an alternative. Every civil production has three times more working places than military production. The conversion program all over the world will develop much more working places than the military industry can offer, because the military industry is so highlighted, technology highlighted, that it has only a little amount of working places. And the second point, this world is the biggest environmental, climate, social problem, needs every penny, but also every science brain, every man and every woman in the world helping solving these global problems. And these global problems we can only solve in a climate of cooperation, when we are not going for war, and then we spend the money which we are now spending for military purposes, for civilian, for welfare development, and for education. This is the challenge we are facing, and we all know this. And again, Stoltenberg and Trump are going diametral the wrong way.
We have about a minute and a half left. At the press conference, Donald Trump also made the point, and something that he's been saying for the last few days, Bashar al-Assad is a butcher. I mean, that's way different from what he was saying during the campaign, where he was saying, you know, against ISIS, which is our existential threat in Syria, Assad isn't so bad. In other words, it looked like the U.S. government under a Trump administration would no longer be pursuing regime change. But it seems like regime change is back on the table. In our last minute, Reiner, what happened here?
You know, we are coming back to the old Bush era. But even with a more worse politician, who is much more unreliable than Bush was, and Bush was quite unreliable, so we're really coming to a very dangerous situation. And, you know, when I sometimes go to sleep and think that this guy having the finger as a button to start a nuclear war, it is not so easy to fall asleep when I think about that. So we are really in a very dangerous situation. And the only movement which can stop him is a people's movement. And, you know, we need more active people on the street protest against these politics.
Right. We've been speaking with Reiner Braun. He's the co-president of the International Peace Bureau. We've been talking about the fact that Jens Stoltenberg from NATO, the general secretary, was here meeting with President Trump. President Trump has been denouncing NATO as possibly obsolete and not paying its fair share. But at the press conference, we learned that NATO is no longer obsolete because Donald Trump has saved it from being obsolete. It's perfect, perfect Donald Trump. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Now we'll talk about Rex Tillerson's visit to Moscow, where he met with the Russian foreign minister and Russian President Vladimir Putin. We are joined from New York by Nikolai Pahomov. He is the president at the New York Consulting Bureau, a political consultant and an analyst. And we are joined in Moscow from Moscow by Dmitry Babich. He is a journalist. Welcome, Nikolai and Dmitry.
Hello.
Yes, nice to hear from you.
Okay, thank you. Dmitry, you're there. You're in Moscow. Yesterday, Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, met with Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia. That was expected. He also met with Putin. That was a little bit less certain about whether that meeting was going to take place. Afterwards, Tillerson and Lavrov had a press conference. What's your takeaway about the meeting? It seemed to me to be mainly about, of course, Syria. What do you think?
Well, it was about Syria, but I think it was about the U.S.-Russia relations in general. I think it was a pleasant surprise that after their one-on-one meeting, Rex Tillerson and Sergei Lavrov also met with the Russian President Putin. I think it's a sign of goodwill from Putin because Tillerson made some statements which are not usually accepted in diplomatic practice. He allowed himself to sort of counsel Russia on what is it in its interest. He said that further support for President Assad is not in Russia's interest. Russia should, rethink its position on Syria, stop supporting the Syrian government, and join what Tillerson called the civilized world. Of course, this is not something that is very acceptable in diplomatic practice. But Putin sort of brushed it aside and met with Tillerson and Lavrov after their one-on-one meeting in Moscow.
Nikolai, not very diplomatic in the lead up to this meeting, the first meeting between Putin and any senior member of the U.S. administration, the new administration. It comes just after the missile strikes on Syria. It comes just after Trump himself has been denouncing the Russian government's connection to Syria. I mean, such a dramatic 180-degree about-face from where we were even a few weeks ago, where there was still cautious optimism that there might be some sort of rapprochement or a lessening of tensions between the U.S. and Russia. But the American government has taken a very aggressive, very belligerent stance. Go ahead.
Of course, it's unfortunate because we know that before Mr. Trump's election victory in November and afterwards, and like you said, even a couple of weeks ago, there were expectations then the fresh start in the relations was possible. But now the positions were different, and especially, like Dmitry said, the rhetoric is very strange in terms of, or maybe this rhetoric doesn't allow much space for improvement in relations. But in the same time, I think that we know that with the Trump administration, a 180-degree pivot can be expected any moment. That's why I think that we can put aside the rhetoric and say that till the fact of the meeting, the fact of the visit of Secretary Tillerson to Moscow is important, that this meeting especially between him and President Putin also is very important. And we, of course, are in a difficult situation, but still, and I'm not expecting, and I think it's maybe too optimistic to expect any improvement in the relations, but at least we have this channel of communication open, and that's important.
Dmitry Babich, at the press conference yesterday, if I was going to summarize it very quickly, the press conference between Tillerson and Lavrov, basically, what Lavrov was saying is, we want a UN investigation about the chemical weapons attack. Two, you have not provided any evidence of the showing that Syria is responsible. And three, we remember that as you are now embarking on a regime change agenda, and certainly that is the new pronouncements of the Trump administration, we don't forget what happened in Yugoslavia. We don't forget what happened in Iraq, in Libya, in Sudan, and of course now in Syria. It doesn't work out very well. That, in a way, that kind of summarized Lavrov's presentation.
Well, you're right. And in that sense, Lavrov echoed what the head of state, President Putin, said, I think, yesterday before the meeting. Putin said that he was bored by the attitude of the United States to the incident in Syria because it reminded him one for one of the situation in 2003 when the United States announced that Saddam Hussein had the weapons of mass destruction that was based on so-called testimonies of Iraqi turncoats, which basically said what the CIA officials wanted them to hear, wanted them to say. So in a sense, it's a very interesting situation that basically both sides agreed that we are going to understand each other. The problem of the Russian side was that Mr. Trump and Mr. Tillerson, they made an about-face, a 180 turn in a matter of 7 days. Only on the 30th of March, Mr. Tillerson said, I quote, "We are fighting in Israel, in Syria, the so-called Islamic State. We are not fighting President Assad." And then, just a week later, Mr. Trump orders a strike against Syria, calls President Assad an animal. I'm quoting what Trump said. And Russia, which did not change its position, had to somehow come to terms with this new situation. Basically, what Mr. Lavrov said is, we're not against investigation. That footage is really terrible. You know, people obviously died, the people who were on that footage. But it's only a video. You cannot declare someone guilty just by merely watching a video. You must come to the spot where it happened. You must have an investigation. And to me, for example, it's very strange that all the cameras are on Mr. Trump and Mr. Tillerson. There are no cameras on OPCW, or the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. That organization got Nobel Peace Prize for the year 2013 for removing chemical weapons from the hands of the Syrian government. So it's a UN organization, it has experts, and it should be investigating what happened in Idlib. We should be listening to these people, not to Mr. Trump or to Mr. Mattis, who suddenly said, I quote, "We know that Assad did it, we know that Assad planned it, We know that he masterminded it. How can Mattis know? He is not from OPCW. He's not even from the United Nations. He's not a specialist on chemical weapons. So basically, the Russian position is we do not whitewash President Assad. We do not declare him innocent. What we want is an investigation before a strike.
Right. So, Nikolai, again, President Putin did have very strong words after the Trump administration was using its own strong words. Putin said about Syria, this was all staged. In other words, this was a provocation. This was deliberately done to create noise and pretext for additional pressure on the legitimate Syrian government. That's all. This needs to be checked. Without a check, we don't think it's possible to make any steps against the official Syrian government. So there's Putin right before Tillerson arrives. Now, before Tillerson did arrive, he was at the G7, and I believe he was hoping, as the British certainly were, that the G7 would announce new sanctions against Russia. But there were no new sanctions, and in fact, Tillerson came sort of with Europe divided. Certainly Italy, Germany, France, they're not for new sanctions. Where do you think this is going? In some ways, it makes me feel that a great deal of what Trump and Tillerson, of course, as the representative of Trump, are doing is more or less for American public consumption. In other words, showing we're going to be tough on Russia. We're demanding that Assad leave. Those were Tillerson's words at the G7. And during that same week, when this 180-degree about-face turn took place, a lot of the critics of Donald Trump are no longer his critics back home.
That's true, and that's maybe the if we are analyzing the results of the strike on Syria from the last week, we definitely see that the biggest result is the broader consensus and the broader support of President Trump and this strike by basically two parties, both Democrats and Republicans. Even the toughest critics of President Trump after this strike became kind of his supporters. That's definitely true. But at the same time, I think it's very important, like I said before, with the Trump administration to distinguish between rhetoric and facts and actions. And we see that the rhetoric of the Trump administration, basically any issue, domestic or international, can change in a minute. And we see that also what is important for Trump administration and for his popularity at home is the support and the impressions. And these situations in Syria provides a lot of space for statements, for tough rhetoric. But at the same time, we know that G7 summit, G7 meetings of foreign ministers, I think, didn't decide on any new sanctions against Russia. That's why I think that basically what is happening, I believe, is that in Washington, the Trump administration is struggling to find the balance between being tough on Russia and on Syria and to make a good impression and to be in a position when the actions of the Trump administration will be harmful for U.S. security and global security. And that's why this balance is very difficult to find. And that's why these confusing statements, and that's why there is basically more rhetoric than actions.
Dmitry, it's true what Nikolai is saying. There's a difference between rhetoric and actions. But it seems to me, too, that the action of sending the cruise missiles unilaterally against Syria, even if it's not a game changer inside of Syria, but it does, because it resulted in so much popular support, or the muting of criticism within the summits of the media and political establishment here in Washington against Trump. It does seem to me to embolden Trump to keep going with this formula, because this is the formula that will work. And we saw right away that he was bragging, and is bragging even today in the New York Times articles about how he presented to Chinese President Xi Jinping at the end of dinner while they were eating dessert that the U.S. had just launched 60 cruise missiles into Syria, and he was bragging about how great they were. And of course, on the agenda there was the issue of what China would do about North Korea at the time that North Korea is still going ahead with ballistic missile tests and nuclear tests. And then right after that, Trump ordered the U.S. strike group, including the aircraft carrier and Trident submarines, to go towards Korea. And just on the eve of what may be, on April 15th, another test by North Korea. I mean, North Korea shares a border with China and with Russia. I mean, this is an aggressive foreign policy, and it's by an unpredictable administration. It seems worrisome to me.
Well, you're right. We'll get back to North Korea, I think, a little later. But you're quite right that it's a very dangerous and terrible situation when, in order to be recognized as the president, Mr. Trump had to kill a few people. I mean, Farid Zakariah from the New York Times, he basically wrote in the morning after the strikes that this night Trump really became the president. Well, I think it's awful that in order to become the president, you must have a sort of initiation of killing 14 people in a sovereign country. That's kind of strange. And also, I think it's very alarming that the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, and the President of France, François Hollande, they supported Trump minutes after his strike, despite having called him a threat to European security for 6 months. So they suddenly liberated themselves from doubts in his regard after he struck Syria and killed a few people.
Let me cut you off for a minute, Dmitry, because we actually have 60 seconds left. I want to give Nikolai the last word. Nikolai, where is it going? Normalization of relations, a thaw, or are we in some other new uncharted territory? Go ahead.
I think we are definitely in uncharted territory, and it's very dangerous situation. Because like you mentioned, this development around North Korea and this newfound support Trump received domestically, that might be the reason for him to go further with this, you know, showing of force globally. That's why maybe the situation in Syria, of course, is very complicated and dangerous situations, a difficult situations with little chance for political solutions. But if we compare what could happen with North Korea and the war, the possibility of war there is basically just, it's very difficult to imagine what.
I agree with you. That's a conflict that will be a regional, perhaps even a global confrontation. And once that were to start, who knows how that all ends. We've been joined by Nikolai Pahomov. He is the president of the New York Consulting Bureau. We've been talking to him from New York. He's also a political consultant and analyst. We've also been joined by Dmitry Babich. He's a journalist based in Moscow. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The former president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, has registered as a candidate in the upcoming election despite the urging of the country's supreme leader not to do so. What does Ahmadinejad's bid for Iran, for the region, and the world mean? We are joined from London by Catherine Shakdam. She is a political analyst and the author of A Grand Tale of Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Catherine Shakdam, thank you once again for joining us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yep, thank you. Ahmadinejad has registered in the upcoming presidential election in Iran, sort of upsetting the electoral apple cart in some ways. Is it surprising to you that he's chosen to run?
No, not really. I mean, do you know, I realize that, sorry, I'm losing my voice. I realize that mainstream media have painted this as some kind of a defiance and that he's going against the wishes of the leadership, but that's not really true. I mean, the conversation that he had back in September 2016 with Ayatollah Khamenei was really, I would say, to be taken as a personal advice and a personal opinion of the leadership rather than an order. It wasn't an act of government. It wasn't something that, you know, was set in stone. And it was certainly not something to be understood as an order on the part of Ahmadinejad that he shouldn't run, you know, just because he was going, you know, otherwise it would be an act of defiance. It wasn't like this at all. And I think there's a great degree of misunderstanding here as to how Iranian politics works and how its system of governance is actually set up. and architected and kind of carried out in political life. I don't think it's an act of anything, to be fair with you. I think he made a choice. It's not surprising that he made this choice, given the political context. And I'm referring to, you know, this kind of, you know, this tension that exists now in between, you know, the US, Iran and Russia and the whole story with the Middle East and the need maybe for a different kind of flavor in politics and how things should move forward. I think he's just, you know, deciding to just kind of step up and say, you know, I want to contribute in a different way to how, you know, Iran is being governed, in that he wants maybe to ensure that, you know, the voices of his faction, his party, or at least himself, is actually being heard, because he believes that he has something to offer. It's not to be considered and not to be understood as something that, you know, is there is no divide, and there's certainly not a rift in between the leadership and, you know, and those different factions and how candidates decide or not decide to run or not to run. I think that would be misunderstanding how Iran is being set up. It wasn't an order, because that would make Iran, you know, undemocratic. It was really just an advice that was given personally to a state official.
Let's help the audience understand how Iran's system of governance and how the system of electoral politics of voting, how the Iranian form of democracy actually does work. Because as you said, in the mainstream media, everything is caricatured. There's no real actual knowledge, and there's one media outlet starts to echo the other media outlet. And so the same dominant narrative becomes the dominant narrative almost instantly. And as a consequence, people don't know anything. I mean, there's a profound ignorance about things. The United States has a vetting process for its elections. For, like, if you're going to run for president of the United States, for instance, unless you can raise, say, $1.5 to $3 billion, you're pretty much not going to win. I mean, you're not going to be a serious contender. Both candidates in the Republican and the Democratic Party raise that amount of money. If you don't have the support of editorials from the mainstream media, if you don't have the support from the military-industrial complex, in other words, this kind of informal vetting, but very real, so that the filter of selected variables, selected candidates who can vie with each other for these different political posts, it's very, very limited. Iran is different. How does their system of presidential elections work? What is the role of the supreme leader, and how do candidates become qualified and disqualified? And after we talk about that for a moment or two, I want to get into the question of what really is at stake in the upcoming May elections. Go ahead.
Okay, so, you know, let me begin with the system of governance. Is the governance of the jurist. And the way that it functions in Iran, and that's very important to actually understand, is that there is no line in the sand, you know, that separates, you know, the political from the religious. And it's not to confuse with the theocracy. It's not this at all. What you have is a system which is very fluid, that accepts the fact that the leadership, as it needs to be understood, is actually the guardian of not just the state, but the religious state, and that it preserves how, you know, the state is being run, and to ensure that it's being run in accordance to Islamic law. That's how it's being set up, which is why you have an imam sitting, you know, at the head of the entirety of the state. And then under his leadership, you have different, I would say, agencies, state agencies that run, you know, the daily affairs of the country. And there's some degree of independence to that, because, of course, there is a need for popular representation, where people have a right and a need to decide how they want to be governed up to a certain point, because then you have the leadership that ensures that there's integrity and that the state is being carried and that all decisions are being carried in accordance to Islamic law. And I think that we tend to forget today that, you know, we look at democracy and just assume that Western democracy is the only way forward. It's not. Iran has decided in 1979 to just, you know, incept that concept. That is actually as old as time, as far as Islam is concerned. It was always how things should have been governed, and that they decided to adopt this system, which is their choice. It was the choice of the people, and it works for them. So now when it comes to, you know, presidential hopefuls, it's very fair, in the sense that, of course, you have certain lobbies. I mean, it would be ridiculous to assume that they don't exist, or even deny that they exist, because they do. But that being said, anyone in Iran can technically run for the presidential elections. I mean, all they need to do, because, I mean, in, you know, you have to be realistic. And of course, you know, people who do want to run and register need to be able to kind of carry themselves at least far enough to stand a chance. So they need to have, you know, certain backing from, you know, certain agencies and certain lobbies within Iran to make sure that they have enough traction, or at least, you know, to carry certain popular will. And I think that former President Ahmadinejad actually proved this. You know, we have to remember that the last time he was elected, it was, you know, he actually managed to garner over 50% of the vote, which was kind of it came as a surprise. So it really goes to show that it actually works. The system in Iran is more democratic than I think a lot of Western capitals give it credit to, just because they think they're in competition of, and then there's a lot of political bias and prejudices. But the way that the vetting process works, you have to, you know, any presidential hopeful has to be vetted by, you know, Iran's Guardian Council. But the way it works, you know, the way it's being set up and architected is actually fair in that it represents all the different, it actually acts a mirror to the system of governance, in that you have the religious establishment, you know, that needs to vet. But it's just set up in such a way that all the council members actually represent, you know, a particular voice within the country. So it really represents pluralism, which I think is actually quite healthy in a way. And I know I get that people don't like it when we say this, because it would be portraying Iran in a good way. But it's the reality. And if people were to just, you know, give it a chance, actually look at it, and then decide whether they like it or not, you know, would be interesting, because I think that people would be actually surprised how it's being set up.
Let's go over the differences politically that we could anticipate in a political contest. We have President Rouhani. Now, there was some question about whether he may become possibly disqualified through the vetting process. I don't know about that. Perhaps you do. But let's first just say for our audience, President Rouhani was the one responsible for, it was his government that was responsible for sitting down with and making the agreement with the P5 plus one that includes the United States and Russia and others. That was the Iran nuclear arms deal, or the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is its actual name, whereby Iran would forego the development of nuclear weapons, and they would be heavily inspected for a long period of time, and big parts of their uranium production would be shipped to a third party. And in return, the U.S. and the West would lift economic sanctions that were designed to punish and impoverish Iran. That was the deal that was signed. Now, Rouhani, obviously, this election might be considered a referendum on that. That's the way The Guardian, for instance, in Britain is presenting it. Maybe the Western media is presenting it that way. But Ahmadinejad represents a base of the population, which is poorer, more working class, more rural. Talk about the internal dynamics. Are those the things that are motivating and driving the competition here? Or is it, in fact, a referendum on Iran's foreign policy?
No, I don't think it's a referendum on foreign policy, because that would be really reducing, you know, Iran's presidential election, the whole process of, you know, the political system in Iran to just foreign policy. It's more complicated than that, of course. You can't think of Iranian politics as being binary. So you can't, it's not really about, you know, the reformists versus the principists. It doesn't work this way, in the sense that you have many people within Iran who are shifting, I would say, because, you know, they very much, I mean, if you really want to reduce it down, you have the principles who are, you know, hardcore, I would say, you know, governance of the jurists, where they understand the need, you know, to remain true to, you know, the revolutionary system that was, you know, set up in 1979.
That's what the media, the Western media would call them, the hardliners.
And then you have the reformists. And for the reformists, you have to understand they're not rejecting or denying or even trying to change the system of governance. What they're trying to do is actually create a space where reforms and, I would say, a bit more flexibility towards, you know, the Western world is actually allowed, which is something that the principles are kind of very wary of, because they understand themselves as being in a state of perpetual rejection of. So it's a different dynamic, but it doesn't mean that they negate each other or that people can't move and understand that sometimes you need to have a different approach to things. And I think it would be very dangerous to just, you know, pin, for example, former President Ahmadinejad as being just a principalist, because it doesn't work just this way, because there's a lot of the things that he has done within Iran in terms of internal policies that could be qualify as being reformist in the way that he approached them. You can't pin someone and say, oh, that this is all they are. You know, in the same way you could say Republican or Democrat in the US, it doesn't work like this at all with Iran. And I think it's a great disservice, you know, to people to do this, because then they won't be able to understand what is going on in Iran and why, for example, certain decisions are being made, or even why, you know, the former president Ahmadinejad decided to run in those elections. And it's not... I think that when it comes to President Rouhani and what he has done, you know, with the nuclear deal, and the fact that nothing has changed, not much has changed since it has been signed, that there is no real, implementation, and that it's not going as fast as people would have hoped it, you know, to be, then, you know, there's a sense where now people feel that, you know, maybe we need to change the tone of the conversation, and maybe President Rouhani is not the best person to run the show right now. It doesn't mean that what he has done is being negated or that they're rejecting anything that he has done. It's just that now there's a need for change in the tone and in the way that it's being structured. And this is what people need to understand. It's not a rejection of anything. It's not a disagreement of any kind. It's just a decision that is being made internally in Iran that the tone might need to change. And then people will decide what direction they want better.
What would be the fundamental difference between Ahmadinejad, who, again, in the West is being presented, and I'm just saying this for the audience so they understand who we're talking about. Ahmadinejad has been very demonized in the Western media as the, quote, hardliner. Rouhani is considered moderate, a reformist. But from the point of view of social and class policies, what would be the difference between an Ahmadinejad, say, economic and social program and that of Rouhani? And let me just frame it for the audience again. In 2009, when the last time Ahmadinejad won the presidency with a large vote, you said over 50%, the people, say, in northern Tehran, the middle class, they were in the streets creating what was called the Green Movement, trying to say that that election was a fraud. Hillary Clinton at that time was very much part of the cheerleading, the international cheerleading for the Green Movement. Obviously, the American government wanted them to succeed. I think they saw within the Green Movement the possibility that they hoped for regime change in Iran. And of course, Clinton, remarkably, Twitter was about to take a maintenance break. And Hillary Clinton said to Twitter, don't go on your maintenance break, because the opposition in the Green Movement that was fighting against Ahmadinejad, charging that it was a fraudulent election, was using Twitter as a way of mobilizing people in the street. In other words, America was definitely intervening in Iran's electoral process, as it has for, you know, a long time, including the overthrow of the democratically elected government in 1953.
Yeah, Mossadegh.
Mossadegh.
Yeah, well, you know, if you want to talk about the Green Movement, I mean, come on, it was architected by the U.S. I mean, there was a great degree of manipulation, and, you know, there was a great hope that, you know, the system of governance of Iran would actually be deposed, and then, you know, change will happen in the way that, that is positive to the West. But if you really want to kind of look at, you know, those two figures, President Rouhani and former President Ahmadinejad, I would say that President Ahmadinejad, look at Iran's, I would say the what he considers to be the base of Iran's revolution, you know, the people. And I'm talking about the working class people. And he has a great understanding and maybe a connection to them that it needs for the state to be able to be sustained, for, you know, the principles of the revolution to be sustained, then you need to care for those people, and you need to remember that they're the one who actually manifested this change, that they're the one who propelled the revolution, carried it, suffered, bled for it, and ultimately wanted it because they wanted independence. They wanted to be freed from any form of imperialism, whether at home or outside. And I think that it is something that maybe President Rouhani is a little bit more disconnected from, because he's coming from a different, I would say, you know, background, and his understanding is different. His outlook onto the revolution is different. I'm not saying that they disagree. All I'm saying is that they have very different idea of how to promote positive change within Iran and where to apply pressure, you know. And I would say that, for example, former President Ahmadinejad is more in tune with social reform and trying to empower, you know, the working class and trying to raise them up, where President Rouhani is looking more outside and trying to, you know, promote growth within Iran by integrating Iran more into the international setup. And this is where they
Catherine, and we have 30 seconds left. So I know it's I don't make any predictions after the November elections. Well, anyway, I say I don't. But what's your prediction? I mean, could Ahmadinejad become the president once again?
Yes, I do think he could. Yeah, he could. I'm not sure that he will. But, you know, if anything, I think that, you know, the Baqai, who's the candidate that he's supporting, actually might just win. Because, you know, Ahmadinejad just threw his weight behind him in a way. And that, you know, the way that he decided maybe to run is maybe not for himself so much, but to really kind of, you know, change the game a little bit and kind of disrupt, I would say, those dynamics that everybody thought were already kind of set in stone.
I see. So Rouhani would have been the expected leader, expected winner. Ahmadinejad entering perhaps draws attention to his former aide, Hamid Begal.
It's an interesting dynamics because you had kind of like pre, you know, nuclear deal and then after nuclear deal. And maybe now it's maybe change, you know, time for a change of tone. Maybe that's the message that is being sent.
Okay, we're going to leave it right.
Anything,
we're
going to
leave it there. We've been joined from London by Catherine Shakdam. She's a political analyst and the author of A Grand Tale of Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi and the House of Saud. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.